The Eastern Front and Ukrainian Culture, a conversation with Larisa Zelichniak. This is episode 13 of Beyond Barbarossa. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry. I'm podcasting to you today from the unceded territory of the Anishinaabe Algonquin people, also known as Ottawa. This episode is a special one. We're not departing from the history of the Eastern Front, far from it. Instead, this episode delves into the continuing impact of the Second World War in the East on the culture of today, specifically the wars in Ukraine in 1941 to 1945, and today in 2022. While the Eastern Front is often called the Russian Front when people talk about the Second World War, half of it was fought on the territory of Ukraine. That titanic struggle left a lasting impact on the whole world, on our political consciousness, on our cultures, and in particular, on the Ukrainian culture, both in Ukraine and in the Ukrainian diaspora around the world. After the Second World War, a third wave, so-called, of Ukrainian immigration came to the West, especially the United States and Canada. So to explore that impact, that cultural impact, that political consciousness impact, I'm joined today by Larisa Zelichniak of the Wandering the Edge podcast and website that focuses on Ukrainian culture and history.
How are you doing, Larisa?
I'm good. A little saddened by what happened in Kyiv this morning, but otherwise good. Mm-hmm.
Yes, what happened in Ukraine this morning, as we're talking, this is Thanksgiving Day 2022 in Canada. And this morning, yeah, the first thing on the news was about multiple rocket attacks in Kyiv and other Ukrainian cities from Russia in apparent retaliation for the bombing of the Kerch Bridge, which, from what I have heard, was not carried out by Ukrainian agents at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard the same thing, that it was like some inter-Kremlin whatever. In all honesty, I think the entirety of this entire war is just I've never understood it. I don't get it. Like, you have so many problems internally. Why do you want more territory to add to your internal problems? Like, it doesn't make sense to me as, I guess, like a normal human being. Mm-hmm. You know, but I guess you can't make sense of a madman, so.
No, indeed. And as we've seen many times through history. So Ukraine is very much in the public mind right now. Here we are in 2022, obviously because of the war in Ukraine, the invasion by Russia. And it does, I see a number of parallels with an earlier invasion in 1941, which is what the Beyond Barbarossa podcast is all about, of course. First, I think what I would like to ask you, Larisa, from your point of view, from your podcast, I guess it's kind of an obvious question, but tell me about the impact or the engagement of the wider Ukrainian diaspora in North America or the West generally. And how much attention is being paid to this war? And is there a range of opinion on it in this community?
So I think initially, I have to start off by saying that if it wasn't for the Ukrainian diaspora in the West, I don't think anyone would be paying attention to what's happening. I think because of the centuries of immigration into the West by very nationally conscious Ukrainians, who then take that fight to their own government, I think that's what you get a lot of the attention going towards Ukraine, especially in Canada, because we are one of the strongest lobby, like ethnic lobby groups in Canada. When all this, obviously when this started in February, everyone was sort of shocked and appalled, and but there's this obviously huge level of support from everyone across the board. Unfortunately, what we have seen, because my husband has his own little fundraising campaign as an ex-soldier and an ex of the Ukrainian Armed Forces living here in Canada, so he has he sends money to Ukraine. But even that, we see it's gone from, you know, a couple of thousand like every week or whatever to, you know, only a couple of hundred that we've gotten for the last couple of months. So it's really difficult now to get financial support because obviously it's the war. Everyone's sort of tired of it. The news cycles are tired of it. However, in the Ukrainian community itself, there has always been a united front. Even as much as we like to bicker amongst ourselves, there's always a united front when it comes to supporting Ukraine and Ukraine's progression to Europe, basically, away from that old Soviet mentality and towards more of a democratic identity. So as of right now, I think across the board, a lot of Ukrainians are focused on that. And a lot of people that were sort of still on that fence of, well, Russia is our neighbor and we've had historical relations and we shouldn't really make them mad, which you saw happen a lot post 2014 when the battles were contained in the Donbas and Krim was taken away illegally. You still had those Ukrainians that in the diaspora who were still sort of like undecided. All of a sudden, those voices cannot really be heard anymore because they sort of see with their own eyes what Russia actually does. Not only within their territory, but in territory that they think is theirs. I haven't really come across a lot of Ukrainians who don't support what Ukraine's going through. For at least from my perspective, I know they're probably out there, obviously. I just haven't encountered any of them.
Right. So yeah, so far within this community, there is still some unity of thought.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Okay. Like we do everything that we can to support Ukraine. And especially now, because we have to. I mean, I think I'm a little bit different in the sense that I've lived there. I have a lot of more connections there. A lot of people who have lived in Canada for, you know, have been born like in Canada and don't really have a lot of those ties back to Ukraine are still consider themselves Ukrainian, which I think is one of the weirdly great things about Canada itself, is that you can come here as an immigrant and your grandkids can still consider themselves, you know, Ukrainian Canadian. You have that luxury of the two identities.
I'm not Ukrainian, but I think I've earned a honorary Ukrainian status.
Of course.
Because for a number of, first, I was born in Winnipeg, so there's that vibe.
Ukrainian, yes.
Mm-hmm. I used to joke it's Ukraine's second largest city.
Yeah.
I always had a lot of Ukrainian friends. It just sort of works out that way when you're from Winnipeg. And I married a Ukrainian lady. So, and her mother was born in Ukraine and her father was Ukrainian. So I think I have some insight, I think. And yeah, that's true that the cultural identity persists quite strongly through the generations. You know, two, three generations down, they're still Ukrainian, identifying as Ukrainian. They're going to Ukrainian dance classes and all that. Now, this is something that's my fault. I should have asked this first. Tell me about the Wandering the Edge podcast. Tell the listeners what it's all about and a little bit about who you are.
So I am a historian by trade. I work now in a dental office because that's, So I did my master's in history in England on Ukrainian history. I did start my PhD. I didn't complete it. both in university in Exeter and at the Kyiv Taras Shevchenko University, which this morning that was the area that was bombed. So it's very weird for me waking up this morning, seeing these images of a park that I would literally walk into and out of daily almost. Right. So it's a bit surreal, I think, still. And then obviously I got married in Ukraine to my husband, who I met while he was on the front lines in 2015. Just randomly, I was looking for interviews with soldiers who joined the front lines, just to see if there are correlations between civilians actively joining a war in these days, and if there are correlation with the reasons why civilians joined during the Second World War. Then I ended up not doing the article, but I ended up gaining a husband instead. So, you know, I guess all around win. We moved to Canada and COVID happened and I got very, very bored at home. And so one day I was like, I want to hear a podcast about Knyaginya Olha, who was like our Queen Olga from medieval times, because that woman inspires me sometimes. And I searched Spotify and I found this really dumb podcast about her, like this episode, but it was like they got drunk and then they like sort of, it was a lot of like haha, and then she did this, and I'm like, is this what Ukrainian history is to people? Like, is it just a joke that you can just sort of like get drunk and then like, are we like the pit? Like, this is the feeling that I always had also at conferences and stuff, where if Ukrainian history, especially during the Second World War, was brought up, we were very much categorized as a country and a people that were either, you know, Nazi collaborators or victims. And you're like, but there's a lot more. There's a lot more nuance when it comes to Ukrainian history. And so I got inspired by that lack of, I guess, historical seriousness when it comes to Ukrainian history on a podcast level. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to start a podcast. How hard can it be?
And so here we are.
So here we are.
I felt kind of very similar to what I found with Beyond Barbarossa. I thought, you know, is there a podcast about specifically the Eastern Front in World War II? No, there's not.
No, there is not.
And then researching the Eastern Front trilogy again, it's like, okay, how much depth is there on what really happened? And there's not. And it's like zero sort of cultural, popular opinion or thought or knowledge of the area
either. Yeah.
So, there's a lot of myths.
Oh, 100%. There's like, and that's the thing that I found going into conferences in the Western world, like England, America, and Canada. And you would present this topic on the Ukrainian insurgent army during the Second World War. And like the questions that I would get were, well, what does Russia think about it? And I'm like, who cares? Like, who cares? Yeah. Like, this isn't Russian history. This is our history. Like, who cares what Russia thinks?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's always been that long domination through history, culturally and in literature. And of course, in the military and political side. And so when you bring up the Second World War, you mentioned this is the other sort of one of the major things that I found is, you know, as I'm progressing with my podcast, I'm rechecking and going deeper into the research that I've done before. And I do notice, I've noticed some parallels between 1941 and 2022. What about you? Or tell me, do you see those parallels, and what strikes you about them?
Oh boy. Well, I mean, the parallels definitely are the way that Putin is running the show. Reminds me starkly of how Stalin ran the show in the beginning, and especially how Stalin had this sort of cult, I guess you could say, around himself where he didn't want to hear any of the bad news, right? So right. I think there's this idea that the KGB knew that there was attack that was gonna happen in 1941. And I don't know if I can't really remember if they were too afraid to let him know or they just didn't want to let him know because of how he would react.
Well, and actually, there are a lot of people who did tell him, and there's a lot of he basically rejected the warning.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a number of reasons, part of it was, you know, he's trying not to do anything that would provoke Germany.
Yeah.
But yeah, he got a long letter from one spy in Tokyo. He got coded transmissions over 3 days from another spy in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And they both said it's coming on June 22nd.
Yeah.
And that's the thing.
You're just like, if this is, I mean, no offense, like he can keep on doing what he's doing because clearly it's not exactly winning the war for him. So let him lead. By all means, lead until your grave, like that's fine. But it's just like those similarities of complete unpreparedness of the Russian army and then the complete unpreparedness of the Red Army. It's mind-boggling because modern Russian today is very much a glorification of the Soviet Red Army victories. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I think that is the problem too. It's like they glorify all of these victories that weren't actually victories from their point of view, right? Like there were victories because they won the war, but they won the war because of also their allies. They won the war because they forced all of these millions of people to go into the army and used millions more as just cannon fodder and are basically trying to do the same thing now in Ukraine. Whereas this isn't 1945, right? This isn't, you know, there's a gulf in technology, there's a gulf in weapons, and I mean, there's a big change in how Ukrainians are strategically using their weaponry and their advances to win this war. Whereas Russia, I think, has this weird mentality of, well, if I put too many people on the ground, sooner or later we're going to get somewhere.
Yeah, it's still keep doing the same thing. If it doesn't work, do it more.
Yeah. Whereas that's the thing that I find very weird is that it for a country that glorifies the Second World War, they haven't really learned from the mistakes of the Second World War, because they had massive amounts of mistakes. And by ignoring a large part of their history, especially that lend-lease policy by the Americans and the Western allies, you know, like, I get it. You have the manpower to win that war, and you did it. But if it wasn't for the fact that the Americans were literally shipping you food, you wouldn't have gotten from point A to point B very quickly.
Yeah. And my father-in-law always told me all of his boys, as he called them, really loved the American food. Mm-hmm. And they all loved the canned ham, he said.
Spam. Yes. The spam was a big one. Yes.
Yeah. Now, I just want to touch on something that you mentioned before, that article you were working on a few years back when you met your husband. Are there any sort of, maybe not conclusions yet, but any trends that you noticed when you were talking to soldiers?
So the ones that joined who had no military experience beforehand, those are the group that I wanted. When I asked them, like, why did you go? You know, why did you take up arms, willingly go to a front line? And all of them basically replied, because it was my country. Like, it's not. And this is the other problem when it comes to Ukrainian history, is when we talk about nationalism or patriotism, when it comes to Ukrainians, it's always deemed as such a bad and evil thing. You know, like, Ukrainian nationalism is bad. But I'm like, but how then do you determine what these men and women did in 2014 and 15 who willingly left their peaceful existence, their peaceful jobs, took up arms, and went into the front lines and basically rebuilt the Ukrainian armed forces from scratch because they had absolutely nothing before, and saved their country? You know, like, there is a certain level of patriotism and nationalism when it comes to someone's mindset of, my homeland is being attacked, I have to go and fight. And that is across the board, that that was the answer that I heard from almost everyone. There wasn't a single mm-hmm. person that said, well, I went because I got money. Like, that wasn't part of the objective. And because they honestly, back then, the pay was not that great anyway. So it's not monetary compensations weren't exactly the motivating factor. The motivating factor was, I want to protect my country, my homeland, right. my soil. Like, this is where I am born. This is where I'm going to die. Like, this is mine. And I think a lot of that also sort of entails back into the Second World War. Those people that joined, I specifically looked at the Ukrainian Insurgent Army. And when I did my oral history projects, like my oral history interviews with them, when I asked them, like, why did you join the OPA? And a lot of them were like, where else was I going to go? I'm not going to go join Germans. I'm not going to join the Soviets, because that's not my people. You know, I'm going to join my people. I'm going to join the people that are protecting my village, my settlement, my house, rather than, you know, bombing it. So, and that's the main conclusion of the two sort of eras of Ukrainian history, was there's a great motivator, patriotism and nationalism are a great motivator. Especially if your country, if your home is being attacked.
Right. I did find that too. I didn't talk to as many different people. I had one primary source from the Eastern Front trilogy. But one thing that did strike me, though, back then, at that time, was just that there were many different factions within the Ukrainian community in Ukraine. You know, it's 80 years on, but the research I did find, the information I did find, showed there was quite a range, and there were very, very different groups. I mean, there was UPA, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army.
There was the group that my father-in-law belonged to, the Ukrainian People's Revolutionary Army.
Not really opposed, but not a friend. Personality divisions of the leadership. There were Ukrainian communists, there were Ukrainian Nazis, there were, and then there was, of course, the, in that area of Ukraine, there was the Polish interest, shall we say.
Yeah.
So there's quite a range of loyalties there. Do you think that that is persisting, or do you think, you know, 80 years on today, there's maybe a different constellation of interests?
Well, definitely the communists are out, because I think they've proven ineffective as anyone else. And I think you saw the last election, I think they didn't even barely get 1% out of the entire country. So as for historically, yes, there is a mishmash of loyalties, and like all good Ukrainian history, obviously they can't be united under one force, because that would just be too easy for us, right?
Not the Ukrainian.
No. It's like, we literally need like three committees to do one thing. You know, like sometimes it gets absolutely ridiculous. Today, I think, is a completely different situation. There are probably still those that have that mentality. And I know that there are still those that have that mentality of, well, you know, they're the Russian, our brothers are the Russians, or, you know, we shouldn't have like fought them. And you're like, you're not really fighting them if they're literally coming into your country and trying to kill you. You know, like, you're not going to have a great relationship on that front. However, I think the younger generation, and especially the 40s and younger, are all pretty much on the same page when it comes to where their loyalties lie and which group their loyalties lie. No, the communists, I highly doubt they're going to come back as a strong force in Ukraine. I mean, socialists, as in like what we would consider our NDP here in Canada. So those like the political socialists rather than the or theoretical socialists rather than the political socialists. I think they may like get a reappearance sometime, but I think everyone is pretty much united under Zelensky now, post February 2022. I don't think that there's a lot of like factions of people that are saying that like maybe we'll join Russia. Like, I don't think that's happening in Ukraine, just especially with the constant bombardment on civilians, you know, like, what argument can you make to join Russia these days?
The beatings will continue until morale improves.
Yeah. You know, whereas I think also Ukrainians have had a taste of Europe too now, especially those Ukrainians that have fled Ukraine in February 2022 that have never been outside of Ukraine, and especially those Ukrainians that have lived in Europe for various reasons for a very long time. And their influence is starting to also, you can sort of see it in the way that Kyiv is run, right? It's a very European city, it was before the bombings all started, but that European mentality, the European food culture, the cafe culture, like that's, you know, it's starting to influence it and sort of being, it's slowly being pulled back to the orbit where it's supposed to be rather than the orbit that it was forced to be under.
Yeah. Now, what about the relationship with Poland, either culturally or politically? It's pretty obvious it's very different now, but within the, you know, between people, there was at least, if not rivalry, even animosity that did persist among the older generation. What's that like with the Ukrainians of today?
So of today, it's completely changed. And I think it changed post 2013-14 also, where you saw Poland becoming a lot more influential in becoming Ukraine's voice in the European community, because they all sort of realized who the main enemy is and all has always been, in all honesty. Historically, with Poland and Ukraine, yes, we have had horrible history. Both sides are to sort of blame. I hate that using that both sides, because now it's become such a stupid like thing after Trump has used it. But you know, both the Ukrainians and the Poles sort of,
you hate having to quote Trump, right?
I know, and I'm like, I hate this because like it makes sense, but it just, the way like even me saying it, I'm like, ugh, I don't like these words, but there's no other words to say. So unfortunately, like, you blame both of them. Like, you blame for both of them for being just stubborn, pigheaded, and set in their ways. But I think now everything has sort of changed. And moving forward, I think there's going to be a lot more peaceful coexistence, obviously. But I think when I was talking to a Polish Canadian here in Hamilton, we were somewhere fundraising, and we were talking and she said, like, all of the stuff that happened in our mutual, you know, hatred and distrust and warfare amongst each other, is that it's just that it's history. And I go, exactly. Like, the Poles and the Ukrainians have this great opportunity to sort of sit down and debate as normal human beings with each other at a table. Whereas for Russia, you can't really do that. They're deciding, we want you, we're just going to bomb you. And you're like, huh?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's, you know, it's very hopeful, I guess, is there?
Yeah.
So, okay. And here's my last question for you is, what about the current war in Ukraine? What does it show the world about Ukrainian culture or the Ukrainian cultural character?
I think it shows that you may bomb us, you may starve us, you may try to completely eliminate us as a people. Mm-hmm. We're still gonna survive. Mm-hmm. We might be dwindled, like we might have less people, but we're still gonna be there. We're still gonna know what our history is. We're gonna know what our culture is. Like, this is the thing that I don't understand. Like, we suck when we are part of an empire. We are horrible citizens. We're horrible citizens even in Ukraine. They bitch about everything. So why would you want that on? Like, why? Like, why would you want us to be citizens of your country? We will literally revolt once in a generation. That's what happened in history. It is happening now. Like, we literally cannot sit still and be peaceful unless you actually leave us alone, right? So like, it it just boggles the mind. But that's the one thing that I want to say is that, like, we've been through man-made famines. We've been through world wars. I mean, horror, like the Holocaust. All of these things have happened on our territory and in our history, and we've still managed to survive. We're still here. We're still stubborn. We're not going to go anywhere. And that's the one thing about Ukrainian culture, is that it's going to survive. And I mean, we're the type of people that will remember how to make a pisanka, which is something our pagan ancestors did 3,000 years ago, and we still do on a yearly basis. Like, I don't, that's what's mind-boggling about all this. Like, how are you going to try to erase this history? How? Like, you know? If Stalin didn't do it, you're not going to do it.
Okay, great. Any final thoughts then on, you know, on the Ukrainian history or the current situation or anything else? Well, let's put it this way. What should we in the West keep in mind when we think of Ukraine?
It has, it's amazing. I love traveling Ukraine. Like, it is it's funny in ways, it's dumb in other ways. It's frustrating in some other ways, but at the same time, like, I literally yearn to go back every year, you know, like we'll plan a vacation and I'm like, we are not going to go to Ukraine this year. And then you're like, damn it. But I miss that like restaurant and cave that we always go to, or like, let's drive through like the Carpathians and see something. Like, it's a land filled with so many surprising, pleasant experiences that literally when the war ends, like, I want everyone to go and experience. It's beautiful. It's breathtaking. The people, yes, might look a little serious, but once you get to know them, they are absolutely some of the best people in the world. And they will literally feed you until you are like overstuffed and like have to be rolled home, just so you cannot go home and say, well, I'm hungry after that. Like, they will do whatever.
So they're just like the Ukrainians. They're just like the Ukrainians here in Canada.
Exactly. So, like, there's a warmth to that country. And I think that warmth has finally managed to, like, come out. Because when I lived there in 2006, it really was sort of that post-Soviet depressing era of, like, there's, like, inklings, you know, of that Ukrainian culture coming out. Whereas, like, I think post-Dignity Revolution, it just sort of exploded. And the people that went to Ukraine back in like the 1990s, I constantly tell them, like, go back now. Like, you're not going to recognize it. It's completely different. You know, like, even the hipster culture is different there. Like, you have the Kyiv hipsters and you have the Odessa hipsters who are completely different. Oh, really? Right. Yeah. So it's just, I mean, I love it. And that's sort of what I did the podcast too, to include a lot of more of the tourism stuff, is just because people don't know a lot about Ukraine, or what they do know is very much centered around the Russian world. And, you know, go experience it, you know, like, have fun there. Like, you'll get some of the most life-changing experiences of your life. Like, I'm guaranteeing. So that's what I want people to remember, is that Ukrainians are awesome when we get together. God, we bicker. Oh my God. Sometimes to the point where you're just like, what am I doing? But at the same time, I love them because they're my people.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Larissa.
No problems.
This has been a great and illuminating conversation. And it's wonderful to hear about the cultural memory of Ukrainians in Ukraine, in Canada, and around the world. So just to point you listeners in the right direction, Larissa Zarechniak is host and producer of the Wandering the Edge podcast and website. She has a master's degree in history from the University of Nottingham in the UK and a deep interest in Ukrainian history. Her show covers topics that range from the history of Ukrainian dance around the world to key Ukrainian thinkers and artists to culture, the women of the Ukrainian Sich Riflemen, and it provides some clarity about the relationship between Ukraine and Russia, and much, much more. Do yourselves a favor and give Wandering the Edge a listen. Find it at wanderingtheedge.net and on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Breaker Audio, Radio Public, Spotify, and most other podcasting platforms. And thank you all for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. For a better understanding of the whole progress of the war, please see my website, beyondbarbarossa.ca, or my personal writer's website, writtenword.ca. Thanks also to all of you who've supported the podcast through Patreon or the Podbean app. Your financial support goes to better audio equipment, research and support for charities that help Ukrainian refugees. If you find that I or my guests or anyone else has made any errors or misapprehensions or just misunderstandings, or if you have a comment or a question, please drop us a line. Let us know. You can reach me by email at contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next episode, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina!